Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I am Gordy Jones, and joining us on the phone line where he's just coming off the injured list is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Gordy. I'm coming back, baby.
He's tanned, rested, and ready, in fact.
That's correct.
And we wanted to talk baseball this week because the Hall of Fame induction was this past weekend in Cooperstown, New York. So what better person to do that than Andy Linker, late of the Harrisburg Patriot News / Penn Live, and now feeds us regular baseball tidbits via his Facebook page. So welcome, Andy.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's good to be here.
So I was looking at this class, and I found it really interesting from a lot of perspectives. You had Bud Fowler, who's the first known African-American in Major League Baseball, in organized baseball, excuse me. You had Gil Hodges and Jim Cott, two guys who, for all their on-field accomplishments, kind of had second careers that were pretty impressive as a manager and broadcaster, respectively. You had two guys from Cuba in Minnie Minosa and Tony Oliva. You had Buck O'Neill from the old Negro League. And you had David Ortiz, Big Poppy, with his 541 home run. So what really struck you about this class, Andy?
What struck me is actually the doors that this class is going to open for people. Gil Hodges opens the door for Dick Allen. Jim Cott opens the door for Tommy John. David Ortiz opens kind of one of those funhouse weird mirror doors for guys like Barry Bonds and Alex Rodriguez and a lesser known Manny Ramirez because of the considerable smoke around Ortiz, especially in 2006 when results of his drug test were inadvertently released, but they were positive for using pharmaceutal helpers.
Mm-hmm.
And what strikes me about Ortiz getting in with basically 78% of the vote, which is a nice total, but a first-year Hall of Famer,
mm-hmm.
is that if you go by a lot of the numbers, these WAR, career wins above replacement, and some people look at WAR 7, which is your 7 best years, or the Hall of Fame monitor, which is done by stat geek guru Bill James. And I don't say that lightly. Bill James is the godfather of analytics in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
David Ortiz, by all these standards, is it doesn't rank. I mean, in this Jaws, WAR, there's also Jaws, but if you go by WAR, if you guys talk about that, he actually was ranked 16th this year in this year's class. He is behind Jeff Kent, Tim Hudson, Sammy Sosa, Mark Burley, Bobby Abreu, Andy Pettitte, Gary Sheffield, all of these guys graded higher. Ortiz was 16th.
Hmm.
And on Bill James's Hall of Fame monitor, Ortiz was 7th behind Alex Rodriguez, Bonds, Clemens, Manny Ramirez, Sammy Sosa, and Todd Helton.
Mm-hmm.
So, you look at what he did and the impact, 541 home runs, which is a great number still, even though the numbers get kind of weird over the last 20 years. The impact he had with the Red Sox and the three championships they won with them after not winning a championship for 420 years.
Easily.
So the Mayflower, that was the last duck boat race. The duck boat parade, which for the Red Sox would have been back with the Mayflower. That was my attempt at humor, which clearly failed. I needed more than a smile. You can't see the smile over it.
Yeah, that's a broadcast.
I would say I chortle. Okay.
Chortle.
Ortiz is a complicated case again. He's the first pure designated hitter, although a lot of people thought that was Edgar Martinez, which I'll still go with.
Love me some Edgar, man. Love me some Edgar.
Edgar was terrific, but his body just couldn't hold up in the field. So I mean, the DH was made for guys like Edgar and Paul Molitor and definitely Ortiz. But I think talk about like the doors that Hodges opened for Dick Allen and, mm-hmm. and what Jim Cott did. And in fact, he even mentioned it during his speech that Tommy John needs to be in there, and he's correct. Ortiz opens up again those the doors to the Funhouse. I mean, mm-hmm. now that he's in, you know, don't you have to look at Bonds differently? And you know, and Alex Rodriguez, and I have trouble with that because Rodriguez was suspended.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think when you're suspended, I kind of think that's a pretty big onus there to get in.
But, I think A-Rod is going to have a problem getting in. I think, but you brought up a couple of things that have occurred to me. It's not just, I mean, people don't seem that conflicted about Ortiz. Voters, I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what I'm talking about too, Mike. Where
that's surprising a little bit. Yeah.
Well, I think you have a younger generation of voting writers now
mm-hmm.
That are more, you know, they're not as old school, and they're more accepted of these types of shenanigans.
Than about Bonds.
Well, you know, I'm going to circle back to Bonds in a second.
Okay.
You mentioned A-Rod, and A-Rod having a tough time. I don't know if A-Rod's going to have that tough of a time, ultimately, because of the Ortiz thing in part, but A-Rod's first year on the ballot, he received 34% of the vote. That's a pretty healthy number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For anybody. Now, obviously, if A-Rod didn't get involved in all this stuff with Biogenesis and the fallout from that, with his numbers, he would have been a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Yep.
But I think, imagine the black eye that A-Rod, you know, basically punched himself in the face with a couple of times
mm-hmm.
over the years.
That's why I say it's got to be tough.
It is, but he got 34% of the votes still.
Yeah, okay.
And the next few years, you know, Bonds is off the ballot, and so is Clements, and so is Schilling. So the people are going to look at the ballot and go, okay, Scott Rowland's looking pretty good. Todd Elton is a couple of public service announcements away from getting enough votes. And got Jeff Kent, his last year is next year. Now, Kent's been on the ballot for 9 years. This year, he got 33% of the vote, which was less than A-Rod in his first year. And, I mean, Kent wasn't exactly, you know, everybody's favorite teammate, by all accounts. But Kent had a really, really good career.
He did.
And probably needs to get looked at a little bit more. Going back to Bonds, Mike, you know, I'm conflicted on Bonds because I believe he was a Hall of Famer before his line of demarcation, which I thought was after the 98 season, after this bogus home run. I mean, Jeff Berman wrote a terrific book on this. And basically, he watched McGuire and Sosa get all the love.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a better player than both of them. And, you know, if I were a betting man, which I'm not, but I would say Bond saw that, and a typical athletic ego says, wait a minute, mm-hmm. and you want to see what somebody can do on this stuff, watch me.
yeah
but to me, Bob, I'm here.
So Andy, you were making a point. We had what they call technical difficulties there for a moment, so you were making a point.
I was making a point, I think, with Barry Bonds, that before all of this started with him after the 98 season,
mm-hmm.
allegedly.
Yes, thank you. The legal team, the after the buzzer legal team is on high alert.
and also, you know, his body has physically changed, and the kind of player he was changed.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's like, wow. And a lot of guys did that, too. You know, you look at some of their bodies, and it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Yeah.
But what you're saying.
Bonds was a Hall of Famer before this nonsense started with him.
Yeah. He was a great all-around player. He was a great base runner. He was a great fielder. And then he just became this big lumbering guy.
Yeah, the only thing Bonds couldn't do when he was younger, he did not have a plus arm.
Right.
But everything else about his game was, just the stuff that would fill, scouts notebooks.
Five tool. Yeah. So anyway, this gets back to the whole thing with awards, with halls of fame, et cetera, et cetera. So much of it is about Q rating and, the public perception. Everybody loves Big Poppy, so yeah, let's vote him in. But Barry Bonds, A-Rod, not so much. I mean, it's always, that's a huge part of these things and probably a bigger part than it should be.
Well, I agree. And, David Ortiz, always had just a gregarious personality about him when guys like Barry Bonds, as we all know from having dealt with him.
Which is another story we'll say for a little later in the broadcast here, but anyway.
On a limited basis, and A-Rod, they weren't exactly warm fuzzies. It's kind of funny to watch A-Rod now try to be like, oh my God, Mr. Rogers wearing the Cardigan sweaters and commercials and things like that. I mean, he's doing the rehab tour.
Yeah,
he is. The Image rehab tour. Oprah will come into this at one point, I'm sure. But, there's so much disingenuous attitudes with A-Rod that, I tell you what, with the whole Ortiz thing, I think it throws everything kind of sideways.
That's a really interesting way to look at this, I think.
I didn't really think of that, but you're probably right. I want to say one thing about Ortiz. When you talk about WAR, for example, that's a cumulative career statistic. It's not an average, it's not a metric. So the fact that he really didn't come into his own as a player until he got to Boston at age 27 might bring down his WAR a little bit, his WAR a little deceptive.
Well, it is, but even if you, another aspect of WAR, Mike, is they have WAR, what they call WAR 7.
Yeah.
Which is you take your 7 best seasons, and they don't have to be consecutive.
I know what you mean.
He played 20 years, so you just take his 7 best seasons and put them together, and he's still ranked 16th on the ballot this year.
That surprises me.
It did too. When I looked at it, I went, "Ooh, that's kind of interesting," because I would have thought it would have been higher.
That is interesting.
Than it was, but.
And some of it is the era, and some of it is a ballpark adjustment.
Well, sure.
And both of those things.
I know Rob Manfred, the commissioner, came out, I want to say last year, and said, now you got to remember with David Ortiz, with that positive test, it might have been a false positive. So, I mean, Rob Manfred was kind of just like, let me smooth over the field a little bit for him. But I don't know. A lot of names were leaked in that. Or came out of that, the infamous Mitchell report. And I knew some of the guys on that list because they came through Harrisburg.
That's right.
I think some of those, the ones I knew, wound up getting involved in that stuff, PEDs, to just try to get back on the field quicker, because they were always breaking down physically with that injury. And I think that's how McGuire, my own opinion is that's how McGuire started with it. Because if you remember, McGuire, after his great rookie season, he had a couple seasons where he only played, a couple dozen games because he was hurt. And I think, he was able to get back on the field quicker and then put up these ridiculous numbers.
Here's a little aside about McGuire. So I went to an Orioles A's game just as a fan one time, and Jamie Moore was pitching for the Orioles. That's how long ago this was. And he pitched a wonderful game for 8 innings. He had this is the A's of McGuire and Canseco, et cetera, et cetera. He had a wonderful game, carries a one-run lead into the ninth. They hand the ball to Lee Smith, They get a guy on and McGuire hits one like halfway to the Bromo Tower. And Lee Smith's quote after the game was, "The only thing that bothers me is that Jamie pitched so great and it took me about 10 minutes to screw it up."
It's tough to time Jamie Moyer throwing those 68 mile an hour fastballs.
And that's exactly what it was. It was just a beautiful thing, just the way he pitched and as he pitched for forever. Which leads to the question, if Jim Cott's in, does Jamie Moyer get a look?
No, I'd like to say yes, because I think he's, certainly did a lot and was very notable. I think you got to make your first All-Star game before you turn 40, though.
Yeah,
perhaps, but yes.
I don't think Jamie Moyer is there. There are too many empty seasons in there.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Andy, at the beginning, you said Gil Hodges opens it up for Dick Allen.
Yes, that's what he said.
Is he the first baseman?
No, because they actually have pretty similar. Very comparable numbers. Allen had 351 home runs. Hodges had 370. Mm-hmm. Actually, Allen was just a tick under 300. Hodges had 273.
Yes, yes. I have Allen's numbers right in front of me. 292, 378, 534 slash line, 351 career homers. And And he fell one vote short this time. And I just feel like that guy, I mean, this is another case of, he was not a popular man with the media types when he played. And it certainly seems to be a factor in here for sure.
Dick Allen's a really, I hate to come back and use the term again, but I will. A complicated case for a variety of reasons. One, he never got along overall with the writers.
Right.
Typical Philadelphia star, just eventually would get devoured by the media and then the fans.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it happen with Charles Barkley. We saw it happen with Donovan McNabb, Will Chamberlain, Mike Schmidt. You can pick. Philadelphia likes to turn on its own.
Yeah, they eat their young.
They do, and they eat their middle-aged guys and their old guys, too. They're just
versatile.
No, I'm not a Philadelphia hater. It's my hometown, but, I saw this stuff up close. And,
mm-hmm.
But Dick Allen, a couple times he walked away from teams.
Mm-hmm.
You can't overlook that. And I think, voters held that against him. A guy quit on his team a couple of times. Mm-hmm. There's no way around that. But when Dick Allen was on the field, in my opinion, there was no more dominant right-handed hitter in the game.
Correct.
Between 64 and 73.
Yeah, fair.
And when especially in the National, well, actually with either team, whether it be the Phillies or his MVP season, and the three seasons overall with the White Sox, if you think about it, and I like to use this example a lot, especially in the 60s. Ernie Banks, who was he surrounded by in a lineup?
Well,
Rod Santo and Billy Williams.
Yeah.
Who was Hank Aaron's wingman? He had a guy named Eddie Matthews.
Rico Cardi, man. You got to go there, too.
Rico Cardi, and you got to go Felipe Alou, who was an outstanding player.
Yes, he was.
In his own right. You go to Pittsburgh. Who's Clemente have been behind him? Some guy named Stargell. You go to the Giants. You have Mays, McCovey, and at any point you can throw Cepeda in there. Who does Dick, and these are all great players. All these guys are surrounded by Hall of Fame wingmen, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Dick Allen, and as much as I love the kid, growing up as a kid, I love Johnny Callison. Johnny Callison was Dick Allen's wingman.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Callison had a couple of really outstanding seasons. Then his eyesight started going, and he was in really decline by 66.
Hmm.
So, Dick Allen had Johnny Callison, Wes Covington, and Johnny Briggs.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny
they're not Willie McCovey hitting behind Willie Mays.
No, that's fair.
If you go back now and look at Allen's numbers and consider, and then of course when Allen goes to Chicago, who's he have hitting behind him? Bill Melton.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, see where I'm going here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back and look at Allen's numbers, in the, you know, again in that 10 or 11 year span, look at how many times he leads the league in slugging percentage, on base percentage, mm-hmm. or, you know, just where he is in the top five in all those categories each year. And that's a pitcher's era.
Yeah.
Those numbers are outstanding. Also, when you consider he was a one-man show.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned this. His 1972 with the White Sox, 37 homers, 113 RBIs, a slash line of 308, 420, 603. That ain't bad. that's a year.
He led the league in on-base slugging and OPS.
Yes, he did.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah.
Now that's.
He was almost a Mike Schmidt-like offensive player.
Mm-hmm.
High on base, high slugging.
Right.
And drove in a lot of runs. And I think Andy made a critical point. Factor in the era. It was a pitcher's era most of his career.
That's true. Yeah. That's very true. Yeah, that's. Here's the speaking of wingmen, I was a little surprised that Tony Oliva wasn't already in there. He won
Me too. Exactly same reaction.
Three batting titles, 304 career average, played on those great Twins teams with Harmon Killebrew, Rod Carew, and that Zolo Versailles. So, you know. Bob Allison as well. And Charlie Manuel actually was on some of those teams, actually.
He was
outfielder. So.
Tony Oliva, and I've always liked Tony Oliva for the Hall of Fame because of all the things you mentioned, the three-time batting championship, winning the first championship, the first couple when he was so young.
Right.
Coming over from Cuba, which is a culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the knock on Tony Oliva over the years was he couldn't stay healthy for his whole career. So, but you have to compress his career down in those 10 core years, which is something that Bill James always liked to do when evaluating a player's merits. And when you compress Oliva's 10 healthy years, it's like, oh my God, how do you not put him in?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, it's going to come up in a couple of years when Joe Mauer's up.
That's a good point. That's a pretty good. That's
oh, yeah.
yeah. That's yeah, a really good comparison.
A three-time batting champion for a catcher.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that you know. I'm feverishly calling up his numbers as you speak.
Wow, that's a picture.
Joe Mauer, yeah, 306 career hitter. 306, 388, 439. That's a career.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I'm surprised he won't pace that high.
Yeah.
Similar to, and he had Justin Rondeau hitting behind him. Again, it's always nice to have a wingman. The thing with Mauer, the numbers just slow down. I mean, he had taken a beating behind the plate. He was getting hurt.
Really
it's not hard. Unlike Oliva.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't suffer. Oliva had some devastating injuries, knee injuries and things like that. And for Oliva to come back, he was just a year, the end of his career was just at the right before the start of the DH or right at the time of the DH. And he couldn't take advantage of it for a couple more years like Cepeda could with the Red Sox.
It's a shame. He was a great hitter. Such a great hitter. So,
yeah.
And here's this was a little sidelight that I noticed from this class too. Minnie Minoso, he was one of those guys who played in five decades. And because he played in three games at age 52 in 1976 and two games at age 56 in 1980, he went 1-for-10, thereby lowering his career average from .2996 to .299, whatever. So he's no longer a 300 career hitter. I know average has been devalued in this day and age, but wouldn't that bug you if you played that well that long?
But I think Minoso, from everything I've seen about him, I got a letter from him when I was a kid. I can't tell you my
just story. Out of the blue, you didn't even request.
He didn't pick me out of the phone book. When I was a kid, I sent him some baseball cards to autograph.
Right.
Now back then it was a hobby. It's not like it's mutated into into a business today, and players actually were very good at responding. Mm-hmm. And I actually, from a friend of mine, had a boilerplate Spanish letter,
mm-hmm.
or, that I would send to the Spanish-speaking players, basically saying, "Hey, you know, dear so-and-so, you know, I really admire your career, which my signing, the cards I put in, well, you know, I could get stuff back like from Juan Marichal, Tony Taylor, things like that." I wrote to Vinny Minoso. He wrote me a letter back.
How great is
Spanish.
That? How great is that?
Yeah, and I had 8 years of high school French, so I was helpless in doing it. So I took it to a Spanish teacher I know, and he translated it for me, which was very nice. But I was very apprehensive because I don't know what this guy's saying to me.
He could have been saying, "Don't bug me, kid."
Yeah, so I have. He wrote me a very nice letter in Spanish saying, thanking me for following his career, and it's a pleasure to sign some cards, and thanks for thinking of the White Sox and things like that. I think Vinny Minoso, and you know, that was just my own story, but you know, from interviews I've seen, things I've read about him, had this great love of the game. And here's a guy coming over from Cuba,
mm-hmm.
winding up playing in the Negro Leagues, not getting to the major leagues until he was in his mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. And in fact, his debut was the same day in the same game Mickey Mantle had his first home run.
How about that?
But Vinny Minoso, like Buck O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Was on that special ballot in 2006 for to take care of a lot of the overlooked players and managers and all field personnel from the Negro Leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I want to say, 17 Negro League players, managers, and owners who went in that year along with Bruce Sutter.
Yeah, I was going to say, the year that I covered that weekend, I covered Sutter.
Sutter was there. And in that balloting, Mike, in the special balloting, Minoso missed out by, I think, 2 votes. O'Neill missed by 1. The knock on Minoso was he only had 3 or 4 years in the Negro League, so it wasn't enough by the Negro League panel. That's why he didn't make it in 06. O'Neill, though, and we all know about Buck O'Neill, and you know, he's an excellent player, an excellent manager, clearly a great ambassador for the game, a great scout, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who signed for the Cubs, Lou Brock, and I want to say Billy Williams.
That's a body of work, if that's true, because those guys, man.
Yeah, and then he was a long time, he was the first black coach in the major leagues with the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, after he scouted with the Cubs, he had a long career scouting with the Royals.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, he kept alive the spirit and the history of the Negro Leagues until it kind of, you know, caught wind in its own sails. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, he, let me see how many cliches I can throw out. He breathed life into that league.
Mm-hmm.
40 years after it disappeared. And he missed by 1 vote, I believe, in 2006,
mm-hmm.
which was a travesty because there were only 2 people on the ballot. The final ballot of 39 people, of which 17 were elected. The only 2 living people were Vinny Minoso and Buck O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And people thought, well, one of them's got to make it. You know, you have this big class of past Negro League greats, you know.
I do sort of.
And then
all of your families on the stage.
Right. And the irony.
All of them were gone, yeah. All the guys that get gone, yeah.
Right, but the irony of the whole thing is, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, Buck, you didn't make it, but do you mind giving the acceptance speech for the 17 who did?
Oh, boy.
And then he got up there, and you can still YouTube it, guys.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best Hall of Fame induction speeches ever.
Mm-hmm.
This guy just oozed class
mm-hmm.
from top to bottom, and
extraordinary person. Yeah.
Really. And unfortunately, what you see a lot coming up is Ron Santo makes the Hall of Fame after he passes.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Mitty Mendoza. Same thing with Buck O'Neill. Dick Allen's going to get in. He should have gone in when he was alive. Santo should have gone in when he was alive. Mm-hmm. Same with O'Neill and same with Mendoza. So that's a real sad part.
In fact, Buck died in 2006, so that was, that was a shame that he came that close right before passing. And his cause has been championed over the year by Joe Posnanski, the great Kansas City-based sports writer.
Right.
And he wrote a really nice book about Buck. So, yeah, it would have been nice if he had gotten in earlier.
Yeah, and sometimes that's where the Hall of Fame falls short.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So when Dick Allen gets elected the next time, that particular era, it was now the Veterans Committee. It's not just one committee like it was when we were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now they have several committees looking at, you know, golden age, old age, I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. all different eras. And I don't know, I think Dick Allen might come up in a couple of years, and he'll go in.
Mm-hmm.
And what a shame. Did something change? I mean, he hasn't played since 1977.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, have his numbers changed?
Right.
I don't think so. So,
not in 50 years.
It's sort of like the same argument that was made for a very long time about Jerry Kramer. He made for the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Right.
He didn't get in, and then he finally got in. You know, even though I think he was the only person on the all-decade team or the all-first 50 years of the NFL team who wasn't in for some unknown reason. And so finally, so I guess that's going to be the same fate that we see here.
Yeah. And I mean, why? They didn't like his books.
I actually wonder if that factored in. I mean, people say that that's not because, you know, they were wonderful books, but, you know, the NFL being what it is, maybe he told too many secrets. I don't know. I mean, they weren't like tear the cover off the league, but, you know, maybe they didn't like that. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't Jim Bouton, who's probably got stuff to say now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Man.
Wow. I threw a little Jim Bouton reference out there.
How about that? You mentioned that... Jim Cott opening the door for Tommy John. Jim Cott in his 25 years, 283, 237, 345 earned run average. Tommy John, 288, 231, 334. And also, just as a side note, Jamie Moyer, 269 and 209, but a much higher earned run average of 425. So, so there's your soft tossing lefties. Also, the 16 gold gloves for that Jim Cott. How about that?
That's probably a small factor in it. Yeah.
And they were in a row, too. Now, you bring up Jamie Moyer's ERA of north of 4.
Right.
People went nuts. Some people went nuts. When Jack Morris got into the Hall of Fame with that 3.90 ERA, like, you know, oh my God, the game is going to implode because he has a 3.90 ERA. And I look at Jack Morris, when that happened, I thought, was there one guy in the late 80s, early 90s, he was the one guy you wanted to have the ball in his hands from the mid-80s to the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
That guy was a gamer.
Yeah,
and that 3.90 ERA is done all in the designated hitter era.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that needs to be factored in. I think Tommy John, and I've advocated Tommy John for years. Mm-hmm. You went 288 games, and the most famous surgery in sports is named after you. That's got to count for something.
You would think.
You know, and he actually won more games after the surgery than before, and he was an all-star before. The White Sox. Tommy John also.
He's over, I think if Cott, I think that's a good way to say it. If Cott, why not Tommy John, yeah?
Well, and here's another thing with Tommy John is, and you add up, he made 700 starts in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And he had 519 decisions. So at 181 no decisions, which, by the way, is a major league record,
That's crazy.
181 no decisions.
That is crazy.
If you win 12 of those, you're a 300 game winner, and we're not having this conversation about Tommy John.
Hmm. That's nuts.
Yeah. 181 career no decisions. So there are guys that don't even play 181 games. I mean, players. How about pitchers? There are guys that never won't even make 100 starts in the big leagues. He has 181 no decisions.
Hmm.
What do you think will happen? Now, this is probably decades down the road, but when wins and losses have to be considered almost irrelevant for pitchers. I mean, the way pitchers are used in this era.
Right, that is true.
How are they going to even... It seems like it's going to be incredibly difficult to figure out what to do with pitchers.
You don't even have to wait decades, Mike. You can wait about, at this point, probably about 8 years before that comes. I'm giving you this guy right now. He's 34 years old, hasn't pitched yet this year. You look at his career record, it's 77-53. You go, big deal. It's Jason DeGrom. Jacob DeGrom.
Wow.
What do you do with Jacob DeGrom when he comes up? He may never get to 100 wins.
Isn't that weird? And it's like, and he's really one of the great pitchers of this era. Is this an exception? And he's had a couple years where he's been like 11-11 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, he won the Cy Young with a 10-9 record.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he won 7-0 ERA.
And deserved the Cy Young.
Yeah.
And deserved the Cy Young.
Well, the guy that opened that up was Felix Hernandez in Seattle a few years prior to that, because he was barely over 500, but all the other numbers were outstanding. So, Mike, I don't think we have to wait decades. I think
you're probably right, but I was just thinking, like a guy like Verlander, he's going to be a Hall of Famer. Matt Scherzer is going to be a Hall of Famer. I mean, there's a number of guys right now that it's not going to be impossible to assess, but you're right. But as you said, we're not too far from, I don't know.
I mean, the way DeGrom is going, 23 wins, you're asking an awful lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe when he comes back healthy, that's terrific. But you know what? In the last 3 years, and of course you got the pandemic year of 2020, but still, he has 22 wins in those three seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So, how can you not look at him? His numbers are eye-popping. And are they really any different than Sandy Koufax, except for the wins and losses?
That's really interesting. Now, you just mentioned Felix Hernandez in passing. I didn't realize he lasted 15 years, to be honest with you.
But when was he last really, effective?
His last okay year was 2016.
Right, and 11-8.
Yeah, like, and then he kind of faded into obscurity. But, yeah, it's like that's a guy I never think of, and he was a dominant pitcher for several years, you know? And once
here he was a Cy Young. He's 13-12.
Yeah. And finished 169 and 136, 342. So does he get in? I mean, that's a tough case, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tough case. I'm not sure he doesn't. I'm not sure he doesn't, but that's a tough case.
All right. So,
but,
no, go ahead, Andy.
No, I was actually going to throw out Tim Hudson in that equation.
I liked him. He had a nice career. Again, I'm feverish.
Yeah, really nice career.
Feverishly looking up numbers. Talk amongst yourselves. I'll give you a topic.
So the other thing is, it's amazing how dominant these guys can be and not have it translate into wins. I mean, nobody's saying that DeGrom is not dominant.
Right. No. Right. And isn't that a big criteria if you're the best at your position or in whatever area you're in, so wouldn't that give DeGrom consideration right there?
Yeah, it should. It should.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I ascribe again to Bill James.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at the core 10 years of a player's career.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely look at that. I also look at, are you the dominant player at your position in your era?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are, aren't you a Hall of Famer?
Well, yeah. If you're dominant, sure. Yeah.
That's Gary Carter, right?
Yeah.
You know?
He's not in the Hall of Fame?
No, he is in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, okay.
He didn't have the glitziest numbers as catchers got. But I wouldn't say Piazza was a dominant catcher.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say he's a dirty catcher at all.
Okay. Tim Hudson, 222 and 133 over 17 years with a 349.
Pretty good.
I think he gets in. Four-time All-Star?
100 games over 500 almost?
Well, yeah. Yeah, more or less. Yeah. So it's a pretty impressive resume. And he was pretty durable. There was only one year where it appears that he was unable to pitch, you know, his allotted number of starts. He had a pretty nice career. Real long run.
And you know what? This year, it was his second year on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get the 5%. He didn't get the 5% vote that he needed to stay on the ballot.
That's crazy.
Isn't it? A guy is 89 wins over 500 in his career.
Mm-hmm.
With a WAR, by the way, of 57.9, you know, going back to that, which, by the way, is Ortiz's was 35.2.
Mm-hmm.
So Tim Hudson's right there, and he disappears. And there's other. Moises Alou was another, and I'm not saying Moises Alou is a Hall of Famer.
Right.
But Moises Alou was a 300 hitter with 400 home runs, 1,600 RBIs, and he missed basically 3 years with injury.
Oh, that injury he had was gruesome. Oh, I can still picture it. Oh, God. That broken leg? Oh, God.
I would not have guessed he had 400 home runs.
I wouldn't have either.
Well, you know, we can.
Here it is, 303 with.
I'm not questioning you, big guy.
No, he's
going to.
No, 332.
Okay, I'm sorry, 332. How many times an All Star?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six-time All Star.
If you look at how many teams did he play for, he was an All Star for every team he played for.
1, 2, 3.
Yes,
he played for seven teams, so yeah, he was an All Star for everybody but them, yeah.
Everybody with Pirates, but he only played two games for the Pirates.
All right, I'm going to give you numbers, and without giving a name, and you tell me if this is a Hall of Fame resume. Guy played 18 years, hit .291, drove in 100 runs 8 times, played in over 150 games 13 times. Does that guy deserve to be in the Hall of Fame?
Not based on those numbers.
Okay.
Give me the numbers. That's not enough.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Andy?
Would you give me the numbers again, please?
Okay. So his slash line is 291, 395, 475, 13 years in which he played 150 games or more, 8 years in which he drove in 100 runs or more.
Well, I know who you're talking about.
I'm sure you do.
and the guy you're talking about, by the way, we'll go back to David Ortiz with his 55.3 WAR. This guy you mentioned is a 60.2 WAR.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good.
He's a walk machine. .395 on base percentage. That is outstanding.
Okay.
You're talking about Bobby Abreu.
Yes, I am. And speaking of speaking of Philadelphia eating its young, that was a guy who, you know, the way he was treated by the fans, you would have thought he was like, you know, a 200 hitter.
All Bobby Abreu did was, you know, get on base. I'm not sure how he won a gold glove, but he does have a gold glove on his resume.
Yeah, that's a little dicey.
He's a solid player. Is he a Hall of Famer, like Mike pointed out? I don't know, you know, it's funny, I guess you have to look at his position, too, as an outfielder, because his numbers are very comparable to Scott Rowland.
Interesting.
But Rowan's played third base, and Rowan has the 8 gold gloves.
That's true.
I think Rowan gets it next year.
That's a substantial difference between them, though. The defense, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and Abreu was a terrible body language guy.
Yeah, that's fair.
He seemed indifferent, and I think that as much as any, he seemed like he was too casual, and I think that as much as anything else didn't play in Philadelphia. But I liked him as a player. I mean, talk about command of the strike zone.
Yeah, but I'm sorry.
He only had 8% this year, 8.6% of the vote.
And I don't think he's getting it.
Roland's numbers, 281, 364, 490 slash, 316 home runs. Played 17 years. So they're actually, his numbers are slightly worse than Bobby's other than the home runs. So there you have it.
Well, slightly. But I think Roland had some injuries at the end. I think the last few years kind of tapered off for him. But again, if you take the Philadelphia part of his career and the certainly the St. Louis part, I think you got a Hall of Fame player there. And again, analytics have been very kind to Scott Rowland. And that's going to help him. And next year, you know, the ballot. Carlos Beltran is the best of the new of the first year guys next year. So your ballot looks like if you're looking at your best WAR guys again, Alex Rodriguez, who's going to be radioactive still, he's not going to jump from 34% to 75%. Scott Rowland got up to 63% this year.
Wow, I never realize that.
Beltran's going to get a lot of consideration, not as a first ballot Hall of Famer, I don't think, but we'll get up there. Manny Ramirez was at 29% this past year, which was his seventh year. Now, I think when you're banned for a year for taking a woman's fertility drug, it's not going to sit well with the writers.
In any area of life, that's true. Now, in any field.
Well, an interesting case for a guy that has been on 5 ballots now, and he keeps going up a little bit each year. He was at 41% this year. Was Andrew Jones.
There's a guy.
I've heard a lot of discussion about him.
The thing with Andrew Jones is that 254 batting average isn't going to play well. 337 on base percentage is good, but not eye-popping.
How many gold gloves for him? How many
gold gloves?
Yeah.
I think 10.
Yeah.
434 home runs. And you have to go back, and if you look at Andrew Jones, people forget that he had 434 home runs.
I wouldn't have guessed that. That's crazy.
In his last few years with the Dodgers, the White Sox, the Yankees, and, you know, he's just kind of going through the season as a fourth outfielder, not doing anything the last few years of his career. So I think you got to chuck that out the window. The other guy that's going to be interesting because he's also shows up on some of the
steroid
talk is Gary Sheffield. But there's another guy that wasn't exactly, he didn't win too many.
No, he did not.
You know, person of the year for the sports writers. Boy, he was a legitimate hitter, though. He was a guy that you thought. When he came up, you were like, oh shit.
Yeah.
He's up. And you know, he's so much bad speed. He was, and I'll tell you a Sheffield story coming up. Sheffield pretty much, I mean, he couldn't play for Joe Torre and he couldn't play for Jim Tracy. You can't play for those two guys.
You can't play for anybody.
It's kind of hard, isn't it? Sheffield was a shortstop when he came up.
That's right.
I remember that.
And he was with Milwaukee, and his manager was Dave McAmer, who later on managed pretty much everywhere in the minor leagues, but, you know, was with the Senators for a couple of years in Harrisburg. And McAmer told me a story one night that they were playing, and it was extra innings, and Sheffield deliberately threw the ball on the stands at the bottom of the inning for a walk-off error.
Lovely.
Because he just was done. He was done for the night. He was done playing. You know?
Jesus. Boy, his resume though is as you mentioned is an impressive one. You got the 509 homers and the slash line of 292, 393, 514 over 22 years. He played forever.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty strong. Yeah.
Now next year will be his ninth year on the ballot. And he's at 41% this year. So you're asking a guy to jump from 40%. He's got two votes left.
Right.
Then it goes to the veterans committees. And I think when it goes to these various committees, they're going to be kinder to Bonds and Clemens and Sheffield and Schilling than the Raiders were. How about Schilling this year? If you guys aren't going to vote me, you guys didn't vote me in after my ninth year, don't bother voting for me for my tenth. And they did it.
Okay, fairly well, Kurt. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of when Terrell Owens got into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and he didn't show up for the ceremony, but went and did his own ceremony at his at Tennessee Chattanooga. It's kind of the same, maybe not the same guy politically, but the same guy personality-wise. Okay, fine.
You know?
Okay, fine.
Exactly.
But Shelley, this year, this year, Schilling got 58.8% of the vote.
Right.
Okay. In 2021, when he was climbing the right, he was at 71.1% of the vote. He went from 71 to 58. And you know when you're at 71% and you're going into your final year, you're going to get in all likelihood. The only guy that really didn't have that happen was Gil Hodges. But, you know, but Schilling says, no, you know what? All you idiot writers, don't vote for me.
Okay. Okay. We're just following instructions.
I'll give you a guy to look for in a few years. Although he only has 4 years left on the writer's ballot. Kind of understated. Another guy in Philadelphia where they ate their middle-aged players.
Okay.
Billy Wagner.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of him. Yeah, I've heard of his case being made. Yeah.
Billy Wagner is a sneaky little case because he never led the league in saves.
Isn't that crazy?
But he's got 422 of them.
Yeah, he does. There they are.
And for a little guy, he could bring that ball up.
Oh,
there.
My
now.
God. And
fairly rare left-handed closer.
Yeah.
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he a natural right-hander, and he had to teach himself to throw left-handed when he was young or something like that? Is that the guy that I'm thinking of?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if that was the guy or somebody else.
But I thought I remember. But anyway, but first of all, why does Baseball Reference not have blown saves? Am I just not looking on the right page? Save percentage or anything? Because it obviously has the saves listed, but not... save opportunities.
No, they don't save opportunities. I don't know why. I just looked it up. I don't know why. They probably.
That's right.
Great question.
Yeah. Cool.
That's a really great question. Probably because Jose Mesa asked them not to put it.
Either him or Armando. Either him or Armando Benitez. One of the two.
Former closer for the Lancaster Barnstormers.
Benitez? Seriously?
No table. Oh yeah. Not successfully.
Oh my God! I didn't know that.
When Tommy Herr was the manager.
Oh, I'm sure that was a very promising relationship.
Brought him in from wherever, and he ran him out there for a while in the ninth inning. You know, save situations.
Oh,
there are two diverse personalities there.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, that could not have been
Tommy Herr.
So, you mentioned Gil Hodges, Andy, and I mean he and his. Long he had 273 for his career with 370 homers. He was, however, a successful manager with the Mets. And the interesting thing about his tale, and he was part of two of the iconic teams in Major League history, those Boys of Summer Brooklyn Dodgers and the Miracle Mets. And I don't know if that plays into his case at all, but I did find it interesting that he got in this year.
I thought he would got in. Really 20 years ago. And the reason I say that is, you know, when Tony Perez won, I want to say 1999, if you look up Tony Perez and Gil Hodges, they're the same person.
Yeah.
They're the same exact
Interesting.
Player. They never led the league in anything.
Huh.
You know, well, Hodges did like 2 years in sacrifice flies. Hodges never led in RBIs, never led in home runs. Same thing as Tony Perez. But what Tony Perez was to the big red machine,
yeah,
as that RBI guy, the glue guy in the middle of that lineup,
right?
That's what Hodges was on those great Brooklyn teams.
That's an interesting comparison. I like that.
Same guy. Tony Perez was Gil Hodges.
I agree. I think I remember dropping that, or maybe even writing they were just essentially the same player.
Yeah.
Hodges defensively, maybe.
Yeah. You know, defensive numbers are kind of weird.
First baseman.
But Hodges was, I think all the years at first base was a 992 fielding percentage, mm-hmm, which is outstanding.
That'll get it done.
Yeah, Dick Allen was in like the 980s.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had Dick Allen play first base, and it wasn't pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't pretty.
You know, but he's not that far behind Hodges statistically, which is, you know, an anomaly. Of course, Dick Allen never got to the balls that Hodges did. And
yeah.
Never
yeah.
scooped the balls like Hodges did. And, but I'm glad Hodges got in. He certainly, you know, again, you look at it, and you know what, you know, it's bad sometimes, guys, to say, well, this guy's in,
mm-hmm,
and this guy should get in.
Right.
And I don't want to take anything away from Tony Perez's career, because he was a great player and a Hall of Famer. But then I look at it and go, okay, he's in. What about Hodges?
Mm-hmm.
Hodges was every bit the Brooklyn was Perez was to Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the teams he was on, he was perceived as a phenomenal teammate, and also his career was kind of at the peak of the cult of the RBI.
Mm.
And he drove in a lot of runs. He very consistently drove in 90 runs a year.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about Perez?
Yes. Yes.
Well, between 19, you know, in a 7-year span between 49 and 55, Hodges drove in 100 runs.
Yep, I have a right funny.
Years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm with you. I'm not arguing against Hodges.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know why it is. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Okay, you have one guy on the Reds to drive in a run on the big red machine. Yeah, you're going to have people that are going to pick Morgan, people are going to pick Bench, you know, and that's fine. But you know, Tony Perez is going to be in that conversation, and he's not at the top of the list. He's going to be number two.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that tell you about that team?
Yeah.
He's the bread and butter guy, just like Hodges was.
Yeah.
So, and to do what he did in 69 with the Mets, and actually starting in 68, you can see that team come around with that pitching and you know, he died so young, he wasn't even 48 when he died. You know, before the 72 season. Okay, Yogi, you're in charge now. Yogi takes Hodges' team to the World Series in 73.
That's right. So, that was that weird year.
A lot of those Mets in 73 were there in 69. It's not like today where you have all this turnover.
Right.
You know, the core of that 73 team was the core of 69.
Yeah, that's fair. So I wanted to kind of shift the conversation. This past Saturday, there was a little bit of, maybe dust up is too strong of a word, but it became kind of a thing, and maybe a bigger thing than it should have become. Because after a tough 10-inning loss to the Cubs, there was, I guess I'll go with incident, where Jim Salisbury from NBC Sports Philadelphia was among reporters talking to Nick Castellanos, who was supposedly the Phillies' big free agent acquisition this past offseason, and he struggled all year, and he struck out in the eighth inning with the go-ahead run at third base. So Jim asked him, did you hear the boos? Which is, you know, Jim's a really good reporter, but it's kind of a shaky question. And then Castellanos responded sarcastically, and later on he said it was a stupid question, and there was a back and forth with them. And then there were all kinds of offshoots of this discussion, which involved you know, when was, what's on the record, what's not, when did the cameraman shoot, when shouldn't he have been shooting, how was the thing edited? And then there was a little side thing between Matt Gelb, who covers the Phillies for The Athletic, and Jamie Apode from Channel 6, where on Twitter, Matt called Jamie a disgrace and said, you have no standing here. And so I'll leave that right there for now, because I feel like everybody's a little bit wrong, all four of those parties. I wanted to go with a discussion of, we've all been in major league clubhouses and just what it's like. And as soon as I saw that, I kind of hearkened back to Andy and I standing on the steps outside the Giants clubhouse in whatever year it was, waiting for Barry Bonds with about, you know, 100 of our closest media pals. And I said to Andy, this reminds me of two groups of people that never hung out together in high school. And I'll stand by that. But anyway, I'm not sure there's a question anywhere in that long monologue, but I would be curious to see what your thoughts are and just clubhouse rules of engagement.
Well, I saw that scenario, and, you know, I got to watch it, you know, after the fact and the whole. And honestly, guys, I agree with you, Gordy. I think everybody's wrong, and I think it was a real nothing burger.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't a great question,
right,
by Jim Salisbury, but you know what? I've asked worse questions than that, you know.
Sure. We all have.
And I've gotten answers back like that, and it's like, okay. Big deal, you know, move on.
It was just the kind of normal human exchange where some person slightly dislikes the wording or the tone of voice, and they react. And I mean, this could happen to you at Turkey Hill.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
I don't even think this has much to do with journalism or baseball. I think this was just a tiny little incident.
Yes.
Where two humans didn't communicate very well.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear, hey, Nick Castellanos, if you were as good as your job as Jim Salisbury.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, I, you know, and the other part of it is, it's a long season, it's a late night, it was a terrible game, everybody's a little bit gassed, and, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Everybody's been at the ballpark at that point for anywhere from 8 to 10 hours.
Right.
It's hot, you know. You're writing on deadline. You're performing on deadline. Same kind. Yeah, pressure is pressure.
Right.
There's pressure on everybody involved. You know what it's like to write on deadline. I don't have to tell you that. I went back. I looked at the whole thing again. I read all the comments on it. You're a disgrace and this and that. And when is it on the record, off the record? And it's a lousy question. Well, no, it's not. And I thought, there's nothing to this.
We've seen
the three of us have seen this thing play out countless times in our careers.
Yeah.
It's a nothing burger. And now, when I covered Harrisburg Senators for what seemed to be about 74 years,
mm-hmm.
by and large, 99% of the time, I'm the only media person in that clubhouse before and after the game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have two or three other writers there, you know, you're playing questions off one or the other.
Right.
So it's more of a conversation.
Yeah.
Well, if I get a guy after he strikes out four times and I'm talking to him, I'm the only guy there. I don't want to talk to him under this situation. He doesn't want to talk to me. He's probably not going to know very well. And you recognize that. You accept the F-bomb. And the next day, everything's fine.
Right. Well,
it's another game.
To that point, I saw Jim Salisbury interviewed today by Corey Seidman, his co-worker at NBC Sports Philadelphia, and he talked about how, you know, the next day he and Castellanos got together, they shook hands and said, let's move on. And it was, you know, as you say, a nothing burger. Now, the side thing, the Gelb Apode thing still kind of bothers me from the standpoint of, you're a disgrace and you have no standing here.
That was a little sharp.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that, but it makes me feel some kind of way, like, really?
Well, one thing, though, that it does point out, I think, is how different we look at things than TV people look at things.
Yeah, fair.
I agree with that.
Yeah, that video was edited with a television newscast in mind.
Right.
And therefore gave a slightly deceptive, incomplete sort of missing gap in the tape kind of thing,
yeah,
element to this, which I think Gelb just completely overreacted to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what they're doing and what we're doing is so different.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't realize that she was creating a record of this thing that was going to be analyzed. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't even know she was responsible for that, for the editing part. I'm not even sure she was working that night. I
don't know any of that piece of it. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Because
I think electronic media is there's more of a presence in it in obviously major league cities.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you get down to whether it's the Barnstormers, I don't know what the coverage is, but I know what the coverage used to be when Harrisburg had the newspaper. And it was a long time ago. Really, it doesn't have a newspaper.
Are you saying they're a disgrace and they have no standing? Is that what you're saying?
Carlisle has a daily paper, and there's not a newspaper within 15 miles of the state capitol.
I know.
But maybe a little closer. It depends if you. That's probably about 15. But anyway, to make a short story long, you know, I'm sure a lot of times, like I say, going down to the clubhouse in Harrisburg, and the same thing would apply to the Hershey Bears, you know, in their clubhouse, or the locker room, dressing room, I'm sorry.
Yes. The room. It's just the room.
The room. But we'll use baseball, so, you know, obviously, much more familiar with that. You know, there were dust-ups all the time.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you're around these guys from spring training to the end of the season. They're there starting at 2 o'clock every day, and you're not far behind, and you're there an hour and a half after the game, and they're there, and, you know, City Island's beautiful because on hot days it was hot, and on cold days it was cold. You know, it was not a great place to be, you know, to cover games. But if you were electronic media, TV, and you just parachuted in once a homestand, and were in the clubhouse and saw some of those exchanges, you would think, oh my God, this is awful. This, mm-hmm, you know, there's a writer and a player going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas, like you say, the next day you go, it was nothing last night. Yeah, it's fine. Okay, what's new with you? Fine. How's your wife and kid? Yeah, great.
That's nice.
How's your wife and girlfriend? No, they're good. You know,
so what? One of the comments in Gelb's Twitter tirade was "Come see me" because they don't know each other, something like that. I'm not sure he wants to mess with Jamie. She's a second degree black belt in karate.
Oh, man, is she really?
Yes, she is. Wow. So
I don't know who she. I don't know her at all. But,
yeah. So I know both of them a little bit. So I'll leave it at that. But I just thought.
Wow. Okay. All right. There you go.
So I agree with what Andy said, though. It is one of those things that in the Twitter age becomes much bigger than it should be. It's just, you know, yeah, everything is magnified. That's fair.
I went back. I looked the whole video. And it was like 90 seconds or something, and I watched it a couple times. And after I was done, I was like, well, can I get these 3 minutes of my life back? That's it.
Yeah.
You know?
Not a thing.
Yeah, that's fair.
Not a thing.
So, Andy, anything else for the good of the order before we let you go?
Oh, I don't know. I probably killed your ratings. you got a lot of trades coming up. We didn't really touch on that.
No, we did not. But, yeah.
This is like Christmas in July because the trading deadline now is August 2nd.
Right.
And you're going to see some pretty good names moving around.
Who in particular are you curious about?
Oh, I want to see who's going to pony up for Juan Soto.
Yeah, that's the one. And Mike and I were talking about this last week about how you saw the predictable teams in the people were theorizing would be interested, like the Dodgers and the Yankees. But then I also saw the Giants in Seattle, and that was curious to me. Because I know Seattle's having a nice year, but the Giants are going nowhere, and I don't see why they would make that commitment.
Well, the thing with Soto that you got to remember, even if you don't sign him, unless you have $500 million laying around somewhere else.
And who doesn't?
Who doesn't? The thing with Soto, even if you trade for him now, yeah, you're going to... You have him for 2.5 years of a pennant race. You know, even if you have no intentions of ever signing him long term, you get him for 2.5 years.
That ain't bad.
Now, excuse me, the Giants, yeah, they're 2 games under 500. They're only 3.5 out of a wild card spot. That changes the whole dynamic now with the three wild card teams.
Yeah.
I don't think the I think the Giants have one of the weaker packages that have been floated out there. I think the Mets have a really solid potential of prospects, but I don't think the Nationals want to trade in their own division because they're going to watch Bryce Harper and Max Scherzer for the better part of the 20s here, you know, sticking it to them at every opportunity.
Right.
Well, so I really don't think they want to deal with the Mets and if I'm Washington, I'm very wary of the Yankees because the Yankees float out all these prospects. But the Yankees going back for the last 40 years always overhyped their prospects. And I'd say for every, you know, every superstar prospect they tout, you know, five other ones they tout turn into nothing.
40 years.
Sandy,
40 years. I can remember when Jerry Kenny was supposed to be a great player.
Wow. Oh, well, yeah, because he was the next Horace Clark.
I will not have you besmirch Horace Clark on this podcast.
Horace Clark takes such a bad rap for the decline. Oh, yeah, the Yankees started to decline because Horace Clark showed up. No, they started to decline because they got old and they had no talent. It had nothing to do with Horace Clark.
Right. Right.
I just feel like 60 years later, we need to stick up for Horace Clark.
I think we do too. Wasn't he the pride? Wasn't he the pride of the Virgin Islands, if I'm not mistaken?
He was. He was. And hearing that, Mickey Mantle got very excited first.
Stop it.
Is it too soon?
Maybe so.
Mickey Mantle jokes. I'm sorry. I'll tell you what. The Padres have a nice little. Blend of, you see what the Nationals want are basically your top three prospects, maybe a couple major league guys right now. The Padres do that, but here's the thing to watch out for in the next week, and I really think if they can, they'll move Soto, because I think that well has been poisoned with when his contract talks became public. You know, I think it's kind of, and the fact that they didn't have a charter flight for him to the All-Star game. You know?
Yeah, that seemed kind of petty, didn't it?
Well, they got him the first, it's not like they stuck him back in like row 37.
Hey, look, it's Juan Soto. Hey, kids, it's Juan Soto.
Look, hey, it's Juan Soto sitting one row in front of the bathroom. No, they gave him a first class seat. And think about it. If we want to be environmentally conscious, what kind of ecological footprint are we putting out there by chartering a jet from the East Coast to Los Angeles for one person?
But you know, it's still the optics of it, I guess. It is just like, okay, you know, this guy, he doesn't want to play for us, so we're not going to help him out. I guess it's more optics than anything else.
Yeah, it's definitely optics, and I read a piece, you know, just a little short that the Nationals had asked the Nationals had asked the Atlanta Braves if you could fly on their charter with them because they were down, and they said no. Like, ouch, the Braves are dissing you. Now, we don't have have an extra seat on the airplane. Our 727 is filled. But here's the kicker with all these teams, and they're about a half a dozen. I can see Seattle doing it. First of all, Seattle will trade anybody at any time. Mm. They love, Jerry Butler loves making trades. Mm. He lives for that. They are very much, they're right in a wild card spot now. Mm-hmm. They have a good young team. And again, even if you can't sign Soto long term, imagine having him for three pennant races.
Yeah.
Still.
Well,
but here's the kicker. The Washington Nationals will let you have one Soto if you give them your best prospects, a couple major league ready players, and in return, you have to take the contract of Patrick Corbin.
Ooh. Yikes.
Yeah. Now, Mike Rizzo, the general manager of the Nationals, has been busy saying the last couple days that attaching Corbin's contract or any other bad contract is not part of any deal for Soto.
Mm.
Now, we all know when executives start talking like that, that means it is attached to the Soto deal. Corbin is due to make in 23 and 24. $59 million.
That's a big number for a guy who's washed.
Yeah, he has not been effective since 2019.
Yeah, he's.
Did you see what he did yesterday against the Dodgers?
Did not.
Two thirds of an inning, seven hits, six runs, all earned, one walk. Two thirds of an inning. That's not exactly. Hey, let's showcase, Patrick Corbin. So. But here's the thing, if you want Soto, if you're the Yankees, you're the Mets, you're the Dodgers, Lord knows what they need another player for, San Diego, and if you're that desperate enough, and I shouldn't say desperate, I mean, Soto's a game changer, but if you're that much in love and you have to have Soto, and you don't mind dealing the prospects, and to get Soto now, it's only money. Okay, take one of the prospects off the table. I'll take the $59 million contract if I can get Soto.
You know, it intrigues me, Machado and Soto in the middle of San Diego's lineup. That's pretty legit.
That's pretty legit. And even if San Diego can't get, and eventually Fernando Tatis Jr. is going to come back.
Right. That's a hell of a lineup then.
Oh, it really is. And if you're worried about Soto's money again because of arbitration the next 2 years, even if you can't sign him, Will Myers' odious contract is coming off the books after this year, and they've been trying since the end of last year to move Hosmer's deal, because that's a lot of money to pay a double sitting first baseman.
Yeah,
keep in mind too that the Yankees, even though they just traded for Benintendi, which was a nice move, except they have three more games to play in Toronto, so he can't play in those games. Judge is a free agent. You know, and the Yankees would sit there and go, okay, if we can't sign Judge, we have 2.5 years to get Soto under contract.
That would be something.
and
workable.
Yeah. And right now, Soto would look really good in that lineup, because Aaron Hicks is on his last legs. Gallo is just been terrible for years. And they're running Matt Carpenter and his 36-year-old legs out there to play left field.
I noticed that. That's crazy. I mean, it's like, yeah, he's not been a good player for a while now.
He's having a very good season for them. I mean, he just got called up. He's only played less than 40 games, but he's over 300. He drove in five runs the other day. He's been very productive for them. But eventually, he's going to get overexposed.
Yeah.
Giancarlo Stanton had his annual injury, so we don't know how long he's going to be out now. And you can plug Benintendi into left field or center field. Soto can play center field. You still have Judge. The Yankees in the past have never been bashful about overstocking their roster. Remember years where they had Cecil Fielder
coming off the bench, or Strawberry off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not bashful about it. Okay, we'll just load up.
Right.
Because Benintendi's a free agent.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Judge is a free agent. Soto makes a lot of sense for them.
Interesting.
But do they want to give up Anthony Volpe, who's their shortstop in Double A? He's supposed to be the next great shortstop. You know, will he be? Is it going to be Cal Ripken, or is it going to be
Jerry
Kenny? You don't know. You don't know. They also have a player who just moved up to High A, Jason Dominguez, who, given the Yankees' usual height, was already put into Cooperstown before he got the A ball. But you know, the Nationals would want people like that. Nestor Cortez has been mentioned in that same deal. Because
mm-hmm.
If the Nationals trade Soto, they want top prospects who are in Double A or Triple A, and a couple major league guys right now, because they got to show something to their fans.
Sure. Plus, they're being sold too, so I don't know how that factors into what happens with the Nats.
Well, I think that's one reason why they'd love to get Corbett's contract off the books. Look, we saved you people $59 million.
Mm.
But by the same token, it'd be nice to have the face of the franchise.
Yeah.
They have the new one. Again, they don't have to move Soto.
Yeah, I was...
Because he's still 2.5 years under contract.
Yeah, I guess there's two ways of looking at it. It's like, you know, if you're buying the team, yes, you want him on the team. Or maybe you don't, you know, maybe you want to clear out and start over again, and you'd rather that the previous regime trade him so that you don't have to deal with the mess. I don't know how you, if you're going to buy the team, how you would look at that.
Well, that's a very good question, because if you're looking to buy the team, maybe you might have hit it. You had something there, Gordy. You're probably privately saying, oh yeah, please trade him, because I don't want to have to deal with that literally $500 million question.
Right.
Mm. And I, you know, the Nationals have to do this right. I don't think, when they trade Scherzer and Trey Turner, who was still under contract.
I didn't get that.
This season.
I didn't get that at all. The Turner part.
Yeah, I didn't get the Turner part. Well, from what I understand, though, they had to put Turner in there to get the two good prospects that they got back.
Mm-hmm.
Josiah Gray, the pitcher, who, you know, I think could be a 3 or 4 on a first division team, a playoff team, with the Nationals as an ace. And Keeper Ruiz looks like he has the makings of being a pretty good catcher. But the other two guys I got, Gerardo Carrillo and Donovan Casey. Carrillo can't say healthy, and Casey, you know, is a 26-year-old guy who's hitting, you know, 220 in AAA.
Hmm. That doesn't sound like much at all.
Well, in retrospect, it isn't. Barilla was among the Dodgers, allegedly the Dodgers' better prospects, but, you know, I saw him pitch a handful of games last year, and it was like, you know, every time he impresses me one sequence, you know, there are 3 or 4 other sequences where I go, okay, I don't get it.
Hmm.
But... So I think they want to make sure that if they're going to trade Soto, they got to get. I don't think they got the maximum they could have out of the Dodgers.
Doesn't sound it.
No. Especially when you give up, you know, Scherzer and Turner.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of names out there that are being floated out there. The Mets have thrown out allegedly a lot of names. Blaine Beatty, a third baseman or a shortstop of the future, and things like that. But If I were a gambling man here on this, and the Nationals do indeed move Soto, I would say that the first team that offers a boatload of prospects, and all these teams, 6 or 7 teams that are allegedly tied to this, all have the prospects to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The first one that says, we'll give you this, and we'll take Patrick Corbin off your hands, gets Juan Soto.
Well, there you have it.
I would look for that over the next few days for trading deadline.
Okay. And before we let you go,
yes, sir.
Horace Clark, 10 years, a slash line of 256, 308, and 313. So not so great for young Horace. Actually,
not so great, but you know what? That would probably be a $6 million player now.
and apparently he's still with us at 81 years of age. Hey, oh, no, sorry. Okay. No, he passed in 2020. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Man, we were so hyped up that he was with us.
No, he's no longer. I misread the. He passed.
An emotional roller coaster.
It was. It really was. Well, that's how it is here at After the Buzzer.
it's after Horace's buzzer, I guess.
it certainly is. Final one. So, reports of his continuing health are greatly exaggerated in this case, unfortunately.
Hey, thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks so much, Andy.
Guys, I hope I didn't kill your evening or daytime, whenever this is on.
It'll be on soon.
Well, thanks for having me, and I appreciate it. I always love talking baseball, and anytime.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Take care. Be well.
Thanks, guys. You too.
See you. All right,
be safe.